Hello and welcome to the podcast series, OK Doomer, which will outline the biggest risks to humanity and the planet, from nuclear war and climate change to AI and engineered pandemics.
These may sound like scary topics, but we promise to also provide some grounds for optimism and even some laughs, well, at least some of the time.
I'm Jane Kinnan-Mont, Policy and Impact Director at the European Leadership Network, or ELN for short. We are a network that brings people together across nationalities and sectors and generations to craft ideas and work with governments in order to reduce the risks of existential conflict and, above all, nuclear war.
I'm Eden Simpson, Project Coordinator for the ELN's New European Voices on Existential Risk Network, or NEVER for short, which brings together a mind-bogglingly brilliant set of experts, thinkers and doers from 16 countries, mostly under 30, and together we want to figure out how to fix these problems.
Over our 6 episodes, we'll dive into the 4 key areas of existential risk, and we'll bring you innovative ideas from whether it's a good idea to re-engineer the atmosphere to modify the sun's radiation, to what we might be able to eat during a nuclear winter. In each episode, we will introduce the issue with what's the problem, setting out a key problem that threatens to wreck the future of humanity and the planet. Welcome back to OK Doomer, episode 3, with me, Jane Kinnan-Mont.
And I'm Eden Simpson.
And in this episode, we're talking about climate change. Climate change is the existential risk that gets the most attention and action today, basically because the impacts are becoming more and more obvious. 2023 was the hottest year on record, and a wealth of scientific evidence links carbon emissions to the rising temperatures and atmospheric change, changing sea levels, and extreme weather events that many people are experiencing close to home. While we see growing evidence of wider environmental impacts of human activity on everything from air pollution to biodiversity loss.
Exactly, Jane. I think we're that familiar with climate change now, it's almost ubiquitous in public discourses, that you could almost say that climate change is the existential risk that needs no introduction.
This is true. The problems are already well known. That awareness of climate change is reshaping how we do business, economics, technology, and politics. And we do have intergovernmental agreement about what needs to be done broadly to curb carbon emissions and keep global warming in check. I remember a few years ago being interested that Al-Shabaab, the militant group in Somalia, instigated a plastic bag ban because it becomes so integral to states, which they aspire to be, to do stuff about the environment. More seriously though, on one hand we know that not enough is being done, but on the other hand we do have a global framework to work with. We know what should be being done. And so what I want to talk about in this episode isn't so much, is climate change real, is it a problem, but what we can learn from this issue about the wider global efforts to tackle existential risk and help us think about what can be done to reduce the risks of nuclear war.
Spot on, Jane. You know, as we've been saying throughout the NEVER network, all of these different global existential challenges, they've got some common problems. We need concerted collective action by states, the private sector and civil society around the world to get together and work on it. But the problem is we're in this era of weak multilateralism. We've seen a rise in great power competition, and domestic political agendas always seem to favour short-term sticking plaster politics rather than looking at the bigger picture and working out, once again, a concerted collective plan.
There's this interesting notion of the polycrisis, the idea that different crises, environmental, political, health, are connected in a complex system of crisis. And that may mean that we need more systemic approaches to improving humanity's ability to deal with those crises, a kind of poly-problem-solving approach, if you like. Of course, each issue is different. Mitigating climate change and preventing nuclear war presents some very different policy challenges, not least because climate change is already disrupting life. It's already leading to really visible impacts that are absolutely global in scope. And importantly, everyone's actions play a role in determining whether we have too many carbon emissions or whether we can rein them in. And we see a real mass grassroots movement against climate change. By contrast, nuclear war is a risk rather than a current reality. And prevention is always harder to think about than cure. Although the fact that some countries have nuclear weapons also creates opportunities for coercion that do play out in reality. And that may well get worse if we see more nuclear proliferation in the years to come, for instance, in the Middle East. But it does seem remote for many people because ultimately the nuclear decision-making is literally in the hands of a tiny few, the men that are able to press the buttons. There's not really a mass movement around it today, although there was in the fairly recent past. But I think there is an interesting point of comparison relating to the sheer scale of the issue. These are two existential risks. They both hold out the possibility of catastrophic destruction, even if one would be gradual change and the other more of a big bang. But the flip side of this is that these risks are coming from technologies that have huge advantages for many and that are foundational to systems, on one hand the economies and on the other hand the security systems that have evolved for decades. So on one hand, people will look at the terrible nature of these risks and some will say nuclear weapons need to be banned or just stop oil. We even have people calling for a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty to try to make an equation between the risks in the two places. But we have to deal with the fact that the economies that we have are totally dependent on fossil fuels, especially in the industrialised West. The risks of climate change are literally coming from the same things that keep the lights on. And, at least for some of the world, the security system is also underpinned by nuclear weapons, to the point where it can become hard for people to think about how things would work without them. And of course, the question of who benefits from the nuclear weapons or who makes money from the oil, these are all extremely unevenly spread. So when we start talking about phasing out the sources of risk, a lot of the debate ends up about how on earth that can be done in a fair way, how to deal with the divides between the haves and the have-nots. And then what can replace these technologies that bring risks but are also so essential to the current systems?
Yeah, it sounds quite radical, I think, Jane, a lot of these ideas. You know, we're saying to people we've got to completely change how our economy works, how our security apparatus works. But when you take a step back and think about it, for most of human history, we didn't have oil, we didn't have nuclear weapons. So they can't be impossible to live without.
Exactly. This shouldn't be unthinkable. And we can't be trapped forever in the present models if they're not sustainable. I'm impressed by how much new thinking there has been in terms of economics, finance, and business models when it comes to climate change. You know, when I studied economics just over 20 years ago, it was still the case that environmental impacts were often defined as something called externalities, which basically meant byproducts that didn't really count because they weren't actually priced by a market. Whereas the whole notion of growth has been fundamentally altered by more people internalizing the idea that if you have total environmental collapse, all the markets are going to disappear and there's not actually anything to grow. So people have tried to find different ways to create metrics and to count for environmental damage, whether we're talking about ways of counting carbon emissions and setting those targets, to ideas like ESG rankings or the circular economy. Basically, development and prosperity are being counted and measured in different ways. And all of this rethinking has spurred a huge amount of technological innovation. So I do want to leave people with a question about how could we think about parallel systemic rethinking and innovation when it comes to peace and security and how we can imagine a world that is less dependent on nuclear weapons and taking more accountable alternatives that are more sustainable, more inclusive, and don't have this catastrophic risk underlying all of them. It's a huge question, but I think there's a lot of food for thought there and a lot of inspiration that can be taken from the rethinking spurred by climate change. So let's start by hearing more about people who are making those changes that we need to fight climate change. I spoke to Olivia Blake MP to hear more about how the global issue of climate change resonates for voters on the doorstep in Britain and how politicians can link the global and local concerns. So as an MP, you're dealing with issues that affect people's lives on a daily basis. And I'm curious how you make the link between those immediate local issues and the big global issue of climate change.
I think that's a really important question, Jane, and I'm really pleased to be joining you today. And I mean, today is just one example of that. Today I had a debate in Parliament about moorland burning, which is a huge issue for constituents locally, breathing in very polluting smoke. And, you know, I've had hundreds of constituents get in touch with me about that issue over the years. So today we were talking about it in Parliament and whether or not more could be done locally, the importance of peatlands internationally and why they're a very significant landscape and how they can help us build resilience. So it's kind of taking that local to the national. But also, there's so many different issues that people get in touch with me about that really matter to them around climate. So I've been trying to find ways to amplify their voices and use this role really to be a key voice for climate in Parliament.
Thank you. And can you tell us about your work running citizens' assemblies and explain a bit what those are and how they work?
Yeah, so this is going back quite a while because I really wanted to make sure that people in my constituency had a real input into the COP process. So we ran a series of what we called citizens' assemblies, which were really including hundreds of people actually right across the constituency. And we kind of held a series of online events at that time because it started in COVID to kind of get people's views. But we also made sure that we had experts in different areas and we covered a whole range of different topics to do with climate. And then off the back of that, we took people's suggestions for policy and we actually developed what we call the Hallam Citizens Climate Manifesto. And since then, I've been using that as a tool to campaign for climate change policies to mitigate and also to improve and make sure that we stay under 1.5 degrees. And that's been really useful because it's not my ideas, it's not my policies. These are policies that my constituents think are workable, that they would like to see other parties bringing forward. You know, I met with Ed Miliband about it. We dropped a copy of it to Number 10. We sent a copy to the Secretary of State as well. So it's been a really useful tool to be able to say, this is what my constituents think. And actually, I think that that's been a really valuable process for everyone who was involved.
That's great. Finally, I'd like to ask what advice you have for young people. We know young people are really worried about climate change, but also so many people feel quite alienated from parliamentary politics. What's your advice to young people on how they can make a difference?
I think that's a really valuable question and one that I think about quite a lot. And I try really hard to go and visit schools and talk to young people about climate, working with different groups who are interested in it as well, because I think it's really important and valuable that we have young people's voices involved in policy making, but also that people can hold you to account. Because actually, you know, the young people today are the ones that are going to be dealing with the fallout of us not acting soon enough and not acting quick enough. So I think my message to young people would be very clear. Get in touch with your MPs, get in touch with your politicians locally as well, and make the case for climate action. Because, you know, without that pressure and without holding our feet to the fire, you're not going to get the action that you want to see. And, you know, whilst it's all well and good that I'm sat here and I'm really passionate about action on climate, we've seen a bit of a pushback against that. And I think that young people's voices in that is so, so important. So yeah, get organised, get in touch with your MPs and really, really fight for what you believe in.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Olivia Blake MP. Both climate and nuclear weapons, the extent to which there is public mobilisation and concern, is going to help make a difference, even if many of the key decisions are in the hands of big governments. Now I'm going to hand over to you, Idan, to bring in our brilliant panel and discuss how to fix it.
Hello all, and welcome to our How to Fix It panel. In this section of the episode, we bring together experts from the Never Network and beyond to discuss what people can do and are doing to limit, mitigate or resolve the biggest risks that humanity faces. Today, we're exploring climate change, probably the existential risk that the general public is most aware of and mobilised by. So in this discussion, we want to explore how this is the case, what's being done at the moment, and what those working in other areas of existential risk can learn from practitioners within the climate change field. Our first guest today is Dr. Zia Moral, Senior Associate Fellow at the European Leadership Network. Zia is a researcher, advisor and programmes director specialising on global trends shaping defence, security and foreign policy in the Middle East and Turkey, and is also the co-leader of the Climate Change and Insecurity Project. Welcome, Zia.
Thanks for having me.
I'm also joined by NEVER member Jakub Gomolka. Jakub is a climate diplomacy and security analyst with the Berlin-based sustainability think tank Adelphi. As a researcher, Jakub is primarily interested in the catastrophic risks associated with climate change. Jakub focuses on second order and long-term effects and the governance of things like geoengineering. Welcome, Jakub.
Great to be here.
Our third guest is Jichong Duan. Jichong is a PhD student at the Institute for International and European Studies of Ghent University. As part of her doctoral research, she explores the complex and multifaceted relationship of the European Union and China, primarily in regards to things like climate diplomacy. So, welcome, Jichong.
Great to be here.
And our fourth guest is the Programme Manager on Climate Resilience and Infrastructure at British Expertise International, Katie Duffy. Katie has been working in the private sector on climate change programming with a specialised focus on resilience. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
Our first question today is, will the increasingly noticeable effects of climate change provide an incentive for governments to cooperate even when so many other things are dividing them?
I think it's a complex picture because you're not necessarily looking at a single catastrophic event around which a lot of different governments can rally. You're looking at a cumulative risks of so many portfolios aligning. And once it's gradually developing for so many of these governments, by nature of politics itself, what matters now is the immediate threat, the immediate challenge, the immediate kind of political pressure, immediate kind of budget concern. So for so many of them, even though there are specific aspects of this conversation they're trying to address nationally, for example, the damages that comes from storms and the weather patterns currently, or increasing agriculture product prices or displacement that is already being visible. But as an overall kind of alignment with so many other nations, mistrust kicks in, lack of funding kicks in, lack of prioritization kicks in, but also geopolitical competition too. You know, well, you have quite power-hungry nations pursuing different agendas than others. So why should you sacrifice your own nation's energy security if somebody else is not doing it and et cetera? So you're looking at a complex picture ahead of us.
I think I fully agree. Obviously, we can hope that climate change is going to unify the international order, but I think we should be mindful of the fact that there are quite a few factors which might actually drive nations apart, because all nations are going to see the effects of climate change. So even developed nations are going to see potential loss of life to extreme weather events, but are also going to see their economic growth be impeded. So there might actually be incentive for nations to look inward and to focus on their own problems. So I think the important thing to do is to point out that the effects are not distributed equally and that some nations are going to suffer much more and much more quickly. And it actually is in the interest of the developed world in particular to try to counteract and prevent these sort of issues before they get out of hand and become catastrophic. So just maybe one fact to illustrate this is that about half the world's population is dependent on agricultural livelihoods. And those are the very first people on the line when it comes to weather becoming more unpredictable. In some nations, the percentage of people depending on agricultural livelihoods is up to 80%. So in those nations, I think we're going to see much more immediate disruption of people actually losing their jobs and losing their income, even before we see other large-scale effects of climate change, like food prices, which are going to affect everyone.
Just to add on to Jacob's point, and I think I totally agree. For example, if you look at some of the estimates that said last year alone or in 2023, the world economy suffered $200 billion worth of damage from kind of weather-related events that are out of kind of usual patterns. In fact, you know, Philippines, United States, and even China are in top five of those countries, like US and China are in top five. But the country that saw the 3% of its GDP being affected is the Philippines. US is the next one. It's only 0.3% of US GDP. So in other words, that example or that metaphor that we say that we're facing the same storm, but we have different boats, it's quite true. You know, some countries are able to absorb forest fires or casualties and health crises that are emerging from heat waves already, or supplement or provide subsidies for their nations, their farmers, their supply chains, and etc. But other nations are not able to do so. And those tend to be the countries that are actually the most vulnerable to the immediate effects of climate change already. So you have this imbalance where those countries with wealthy resources are able to respond, adapt into some of the current kind of challenges. And those nations that are the most vulnerable to climate change risks, and they will actually face increasingly worrying outcomes of this, they are already struggling to meet the challenges right here.
I think I would just add a very important concept, which is nationally determined contributions, the NDCs, which refers to the different perspective of their equity and justice principle. I think this kind of differentiation is especially between developed and developing countries. Because for some developing countries, especially some emerging ones like China, India, or Brazil, they always emphasize historical emissions. And they would argue that developed countries have historically contributed the most to greenhouse gas emission. So they are supposed to take more responsibility. But for developed countries, this kind of standard is out of date. And they would like to emphasize more on the current emission or the economic capacity. So that's their differences. Also, our international society is in the end under an anarchical status. So governments are actually seeking to balance their national interests and their global objectives. So for most of them, their national interests are still their main priority, and they would like to obey international rules only when there is no risk for their sovereignty or security. And whenever there are some disputes, they may just withdraw from the negotiating table, just like what Trump did. And that's the problem.
I think the point is also partly that so far, climate change has always been an abstract challenge of sort of arguing and bartering about emissions, like you were just saying, Yichong. But probably what we have to expect in the next years and decades is it becoming actually a much more serious and much more immediate threat, where it intersects with fragility in developing states in particular. And I think that's the point where the conversation has to shift, and we can no longer afford just to look at mitigation. We have to keep doing that, obviously, but we have to deal with the harsh reality of adaptation. And I think that's where the real divide is going to emerge in terms of adaptation. As we said earlier, capacity is just hugely different dependent on either developing or developed states. And I think here pointing out and illustrating that for now, developed countries might not be affected as strongly, but eventually they are going to have to suffer the consequences as well if the developing world is struggling and is impeded in its growth and security. I think that's the sort of likely trajectory for next years.
I also want to add that for now, I do believe whether there will be further cooperation is still depending on their collective willingness to prioritize the global justice and like how to find a better engagement in the meaningful dialogue or cooperation, and to find more decisive actions. But at least for now, I think we still have a long way to go.
So I think Jakob did a really good point about mitigation versus adaptation question, right? So I think a lot of particularly public attention is focusing rightfully and has to on the long-term kind of mitigation push, which is reduction of the greenhouse emissions and et cetera. And we have to continue with that. But the reality is, even with the best case scenario commitments and new ones and them being kind of delivered, which is, again, one is, you know, one has reasons to be wary of whether such promises will be followed up. You are looking at next 10, 20, 30 years that will already see these increased temperatures with all these kind of weather patterns that we're already witnessing. So that's why the immediacy of adaptation conversation has to be taken much more seriously. And at so many different levels, not just global kind of assuming this, there is this kind of value or politics-free international community that can act. And I struggle to find where it is. But at national levels, as we've already focused on, they do have the priority to take care of their own citizens or even enable a global conversation. But we also need to think about very local levels, you know, at the unit levels of, if you like, the village, the town, the city, and even our companies, charities, educational institutions, and all the risks that come with climate change affect all of them. I mean, you can see that practically in, for example, our insurance companies are struggling to conceptualize whether they can provide house insurances for people living in California or Florida with storms and forest fires and et cetera. And that is going to affect people both in countries that are wealthier in terms of people's economic choices and possibilities, but it's also the countries that are already seeing increased numbers of displacement in West and East Africa and all the issues that come with water management questions in the Middle East. So there is an aspect of climate change conversation that it is no longer far away. It's already here. We've already passed that 1.5 Celsius increase in the temperature, and that's not going to revert back easily to what we've been accustomed to.
I think once we see these local low-level impacts Ziyech has talked about, I think that might actually change the international dynamic to the point where I think the nations suffering most on these consequences might be much more incentivized to take seriously the sort of global authority that actually provides any sort of relief, be it in terms of effective mitigation, but also in terms of offering, for example, financing for adaptation. So I think one possible pathway towards more international cooperation might actually be towards a sort of hegemony of those who deal best with climate change and who lead by example and can provide the sort of resources needed by developing countries.
On the solutions point, we talk a lot about how the horse has bolted, things have happened already, and it's going to get worse in future as well. But people are working on this. So are there some scientific solutions that are currently, you know, developing as we speak that policymakers are ignoring or neglecting or not really utilising properly? But also I wanted to know, are there any risks from kind of like relying on a more sort of scientific, technological way of beating climate change as opposed to these international things?
So I think some people are quite hopeful about the possibility of geoengineering our way out of the climate crisis, which is essentially the hope that certain technologies will allow us to mitigate the effects of climate change and reduce temperatures by technological interventions like solar radiation modification. I think what has to be said is that these technologies are highly speculative and untested, almost by definition, because the only way to properly test them would be to implement them. And implementation is potentially very dangerous because everything we can foresee in this regard means that it's highly uncertain, not just on a technical level, but also on a political level. Because any sort of weather modification would have vastly different effects in different parts of the world. So even if it were to effectively reduce temperatures in one part of the world, it would affect the water cycle elsewhere and thereby lead to this sort of political tension that I think is actually the greatest risk of climate change, incentivizing interstate conflict potentially. So I will have to say that I think the only best but also hardest solution to tackle climate change is the obvious one, which is to focus on a just transition and socioeconomic development. So a two-pronged approach of decarbonization but also adaptation. And this means that in particular developed countries will have to decarbonize as quickly as possible, but also provide the technical and financial resources to developing countries to actually decarbonize as well. Because as we know, it's developing countries like China and India, which are now the greatest total emitters. So it's in our interest to reduce that, but then to also move on to resilience and to provide the know-how and also resources to actually make states resilient and make them be able to survive climate change.
I believe the governments care much more on the technical measures to, for example, manage the radiation or carbon dioxide. But I think it's also necessary to pay more attention on the circular economy, especially the production or consumption pattern. I think one of these kind of example can be the EU's deforestation-free regulation. It's on the supply chain. Although it's not specifically on climate change, it calls for the due diligence on supply chain and the consumption. And I think this way can also be used for addressing climate change to achieve some kind of low carbon economy. But for this kind of measure, there may be many resistance from the vested interests or entrenched economic systems. So that's why I think for now it's not received many attention. That's my opinion.
I think there's also a lot to be said for people understanding these new technologies and educating around them, because to get popular support for them so governments can implement these, people are going to need to understand what they are and where their money is going to. And if you're telling them that there's these associated risks, you're not entirely sure, it's been tried here and it may have not done the best, and this is where their money is going, but it's also where they're putting their faith for combating the climate crisis itself in. There's a lot to be done for educating around what these new technologies are and how accessible they are, and if they really are the best solutions going forward for each government, because there's also much evaluation and measuring to be done and the amount of money to put into it.
But I think, as Jakub made and the other points that have been made in this kind of adaptation process, we're also going to see another type of risk increasing. That just like new technologies bring with themselves a lot of risks, so the unknown, what that might lead to. Even in energy transition, we face the risk of impact on geopolitical balances, national politics. For example, if you think about countries like Nigeria and Iraq, and as you push for a kind of move away from fossil fuel, and those two countries heavily rely on those energy sources and the income that comes from them. So by reducing the demand for that, you're increasingly making such two large countries quite vulnerable to political and social unrest and economic needs that unless you plan now, as we're pushing to cut down the emissions, you are going to create these issues. Perhaps others like Saudi Arabia or UAE or Qatar, etc., and Bahrain might survive the shift to different models of economy because they have enough kind of sovereign funds and savings. Those other countries won't be able to. And in fact, Nigeria is the most populous country in Africa. So if it doesn't have oil revenues, then it will face a huge social political challenge ahead of it. And it will lead to displacement. It will lead to radicalization. It will potentially bring back military coups again and secessionist movements and etc. So while we are kind of rightfully pushing for that mitigation strategy as our main focus, and totally agree, quick technology is not the solution, but it also comes with a risk. So unless we plan the human context of what we're pushing, we are actually only going to see further challenges pile up in front of us.
Well, it's essential to keep up the hope in the green transition and to really illustrate to people that this is the best choice we have. I think sort of showing that it's not a silver bullet. So neither geoengineering, but also even decarbonization brings with it a lot of downsides. So both on a geopolitical level, as Yair just said, but even on a very minor local level, lots of green technology like batteries need mining that needs to be scaled up on a massive scale. That mining can then increase insecurity in local contexts, for example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So I think being mindful of that and preparing for that is the best we can do, even while going head on into decarbonization and just transition.
So moving on to our third question now, we've determined now that as much as, let's say, governments aren't doing as much as they can do, they are doing things. And as I said at the start of this panel, arguably climate change is the existential risk that people around the world get most mobilized by. And I was just wondering, what can practitioners working in other areas of existential risk, let's say like the nuclear field, in the biofield, in, you know, emerging disruptive technologies, what can they learn from the climate change movement and its ability to mobilize young people, activists, the general public?
So I think with the climate movement and its ability to mobilize, because it's so multifaceted and encompassing, it encompasses so many other movements. It goes across gender, nationality, the sector you work in, your class, labor movements, feminist movements, human rights, indigenous rights. And because of that, so many different voices are given platforms and heard and represented. And they also have so many different stakes in the different issues. So there's a lot to be said for the coalition building for the climate movement. It includes young people, grassroots organizations, policymakers. And it works at like local levels, national levels, at the international level. And I feel like this lends so much sway to, because there's so many inroads for different people to become mobilized within this movement.
Yeah, and I think in these kind of movements, they also make quite good use of the social media and coverage, because all of these visible problems receive many more media coverage, like the news on the latest scientific findings, extreme weather events, and also some policy developments. I can remember clearly that during the Amazon fire, which is believed to be caused by climate change, partly, and every day there was a 24-hour news cycle on the website or on the TV, including some quite frightening pictures. And all of these raises the awareness of many citizens and also just encourage them to engage in this kind of action. But I think for some other existential problems, like the nuclear weapon issues, I think still for now, many people just believe this problem is very far away from them. And this is quite high level and related more to the government. And they are not offered with very practical solutions in their real life. So they may choose to just ignore it or just leave it to the government.
Just to build upon that a little bit, I feel like with the climate movement as well, there's so much youth engagement with it. Like people have grown up with this cause, and because they've grown up with this cause, they identify with it more and they can see it happening around them. There's a lot more youth empowerment within the discussions. And from this, there's a lot more personal relevance to the issue. It's a lot more tangible. And I feel like there is a bit of that lacking in other areas of existential risk that we've spoken about. And because of this personal impact felt by the crisis, because it's conveyed so well, they've done a really, really good job of making it accessible to so many different people of so many different ages that it's easier to mobilize with.
I think thinking of other causes for existential risk, we also shouldn't have a competitive mindset, because climate change also isn't doing great. We're still not on the right track in terms of actually fixing the problem. And I think in reverse, climate change also isn't just climate change. I think it's just the tip of a melting iceberg, which is a larger environmental crisis of resource use. And it also interacts with basically every other existential risk we have. It increases the risk of great power competition, of nuclear conflict. It leads to the undermining of the liberal international order. So I think instead of trying to play these different causes out against each other, we should just be mindful of the poly crisis that emerges as climate change wrecks our world, which is already threatened from other angles as well.
I think there's also the question of fatigue and a sense of kind of overwhelmed feeling that people often feel when we talk about existential risk. So obviously we focus on scenarios that are quite directly impacting on people's lives and might get worse ahead of us. So that ranges everything from potential wars to a catastrophic kind of question about the very habitability of our planet. So I think there is a sense that, you know, for so many people, the right audience hears these conversations and they often feel overwhelmed about it. So how do we communicate these risks in such a way that we're able to break them down to specific actions, specific kind of things individuals can do, their units can do, their nations can do? I think that would be quite helpful, because otherwise it does lead to people feeling overwhelmed by all of these and not basically seeing where they fit in, where their country fits in, or where their organization could fit in. So perhaps that's what we could do as those of us who work in risks and with an existential risk kind of focus, is to say, how do we communicate? How do we encourage tangible, actionable solutions that are actually quite possible at these different levels? And perhaps that's something we can all learn and work towards together.
I quite liked what Jakob was saying earlier on about the kind of like the midst of the poly crisis thing, and how, like, you know, climate change isn't doing so well itself either when it comes to resource allocation and things like that. What could you guys here working in climate change, what do you think you could learn from people working in other areas of existential risk?
I feel like because all of these risks are so interconnected, I would like to learn more and know more about how they can be symbiotic in nature and how AI can work with climate and nuclear as well, and obviously know about that as well. But I feel like sometimes there can be a bit of a disconnect in the learning about how the two can work together for solutions that will benefit both sides of the coin, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I was going to say, I feel like AI is the hot one at the moment as well, and especially with terms, a lot of people think about it as a problem, but you're absolutely right. Of course, there are ways that we can use it to help us rather than hinder.
I think other existential risk causes have been very good at building cater organizations and sort of organizing people, a small group of people, but having very good organization on that. So I think we've seen that in artificial intelligence, where you have some groups and institutes which are really concerned with AI safety, which manage to be really organized, attract funding on research. And I think we could maybe take some of that back into the sort of larger problem of climate policy, where I think sometimes there's a bit of fatigue thinking that all of these questions are so large that they can only be tackled on the greatest possible level policy, where people don't really dare to venture. But I think maybe we need this sort of entrepreneurial mindset of trying to come in, trying to suggest solutions, trying to advocate for positions.
I just wondered if anyone had any comments to make at all about the role of the private sector in this, because I feel it's a bit more of an obvious one than it would be with, let's say, nuclear weapons per se, which is a very much a governmental business. Whereas this one here, we've already alluded that it is the private sector which is causing these problems, but also could have some of the solutions.
So the private sector do a lot for regulation, as we were talking about NDCs and stuff earlier. They help governments with their NDCs, but also in the terms of they use up so much resource in trade and export and in their general operations. And so then when you that becomes ESG standards, and then you're regulating the ESG standards because the industry uses up so much resource across the world. So they actually can be purveyors of setting a standard in the way businesses should operate. And now there's a massive incentive to work towards your ESG goals and become the best you can be in your business operations internally and externally to be sustainable, to set an example, because then you look like a better company, but you're also having a better impact on the planet. And the more sustainable you are, the more likely people are to fund you and to support you. And so if that's the industry standards that's being set, people are still going to keep going for that.
Thanks, Katie. It's good to hear as well at the end this kind of idea that it isn't just governments telling people what to do. You can actually have, it's quite nice to think that you can have companies and individuals and so on, like leading ahead besides government. I'd like to thank everyone for joining in today's discussion. So thank you, Zia. Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Jakob. And thank you, Ji-Chong. We're going to move on now over to Jane, and we're going to have a look at an example from history where humanity has been on the very precipice of destruction thanks to existential risk, but nonetheless managed to step back from the brink. So over to you, Jane.
On this episode's Turn Back the Clock feature, we're going to look back to the discovery of the man-made hole in the ozone layer and try to learn more about how people got together to stop the damage that was being done by CFCs to the atmosphere at that time. And I'm really excited to be joined by Professor Susan Solomon, who worked with a team to demonstrate that it was CFCs that were causing the hole in the ozone layer over the Antarctic. Professor Solomon is the Ellen Swallow Richards Professor of Atmospheric Chemistry and Climate Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the winner of so many awards that it's not possible to count or list them, but they do include being a joint recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize and the recipient of a Future of Life Award, among many others. And I'd love to hear from you. What led you to become a scientist in the first place?
Well, you know, people always think that television is bad for kids. But actually, when Jacques Cousteau came on American television, I think more or less for the first time, I was about 9 years old. And The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau was the name of the show. And I was absolutely fascinated. When I saw that, I decided right then I was definitely going to be a scientist. I thought I would be a biologist, but when I got to high school, I decided I liked chemistry better. So here I am all these years later, studying the planet as Jacques Cousteau did. And interestingly enough, when I talk to people my age, I find that it's a fairly large number who, like me, were inspired by Jacques Cousteau. So TV is not all bad. That's my message.
Oh, that's really interesting. And that's definitely a message that my kids will be very pleased to hear. So tell us how you came to demonstrate that CFCs were in fact responsible for the hole in the ozone layer.
Well, the chlorofluorocarbons are compounds that we were using in large amounts for everything from spray cans to refrigerators at that time. There was a tremendous amount being poured into the atmosphere every year. We thought that if we kept doing that, we would see a small change far in the future, that, you know, you'd get something like a 5% depletion in the ozone layer in 100 years, a future problem. And then all of a sudden, this ozone hole opens up over the Antarctic. Why only the Antarctic, not in the Arctic? We had to go down there to actually make measurements to figure it out, because in those days, we had very limited satellite data. So it was very exciting. We used different wavelengths of light to get information about chemicals that were over our heads in the atmosphere, in the ozone layer. And what we found was that there were very large amounts of certain kinds of chlorine compounds, which had to have come from the chlorofluorocarbons. Chlorofluorocarbons are overwhelmingly still the source of chlorine to the stratosphere. And that stuff was being chemically altered by something in the Antarctic atmosphere. And that something was clouds. It's so cold in the Antarctic that clouds actually form at those altitudes. Normally, you don't have clouds, you know, at stratospheric levels where the ozone layer is. It's just too dry. But in the Antarctic, it's so incredibly cold that you form surfaces. Those surfaces change the chemistry. And we were able to show that through measuring some of the chemicals that are associated with that, that destroy ozone.
Wow.
So it was very exciting. It just didn't look like the chemistry anywhere else.
It's interesting you say it was very exciting. I mean, it must have been amazing to make this discovery. But was it also frightening to see what was happening and see how fast it was happening?
It was. I have to say that I wasn't quite that frightened when we did it in the Antarctic, because you might imagine that the Antarctic is just a bellwether for the rest of the world. I mean, let's face it, there's not a lot of biological life down there. There's no trees. There's no vegetation really of any kind. The only thing you've got are penguins and seals, and they spend almost all their time underwater. You know, it's just a snow-covered, icy, endless, magnificently beautiful crystal palace. So, you know, if you had to have an ozone hole anywhere, that was a pretty good place to have one. You could imagine that it was sort of like the canary in the coal mine telling us, hey, humans, you better change what you're doing. If that was the case, you know, then it would be something to worry about at some level, but it wouldn't be really frightening. But what really got frightening was when we began to see that that same chemistry could operate to a lesser extent in other places. We saw the same thing in the Arctic. That actually did frighten me the first time I went to the Arctic and made measurements that showed similar things. Then I realized, hey, this isn't just an Antarctic thing. This is everywhere. Not quite as bad as the Antarctic, but more serious than we thought.
So I'm really curious how your discoveries and your evidence then were used to actually influence global action, because sometimes with climate change, it feels like people are gathering evidence, but that vested interests, businesses, governments sometimes don't want to know. So how did things start to change?
Well, that's to tell that whole story would take way more time than we have. So I'm going to tell you a very abbreviated version. I think it's clear that science alone is never enough to solve an environmental problem, but it's always necessary. So it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. And the science in this case, it was a bit of a shock to the world that we had this ozone hole that we never expected. So the realization that this problem was going to be so much worse than we thought, demonstrated by measurements, really pushed a lot of people into action. Shortly after clear evidence came out that changes were happening not just in the Antarctic, but at other places, the DuPont Corporation announced that they would no longer make these chemicals. That was huge. That was absolutely huge. And that's about the time that the Montreal Protocol was agreed, actually a little bit earlier than that. So the Montreal Protocol to protect the ozone layer is an international treaty that was developed in 1987. It wasn't ratified in the United States until 1988. And I think the reason why ratification happened is because the evidence by that time had become so clear. So ratification in the United States is one of the hardest things that we do. The Senate has to have a two-thirds majority vote to ratify a treaty, partly because, you know, a lot of people in the United States are a little nervous about international agreements, rightly or wrongly. And in this case, it was so clear that the vote in the Senate was 88-0. I mean, just astonishing. So sometimes science can actually have a big impact. Now, the DuPont company also was under, I think, a lot of pressure to do something different because people in the U.S. had completely given up spray cans. I mean, the very idea that it might cause ozone depletion someday in the future was enough to actually activate the American public to go to their medicine cabinets and, you know, throw away the spray underarm deodorant and get the roll-on instead. I mean, how hard is that? You'd have to be a cretin not to do it, really. So it was I don't want to call Europeans cretins. That's not my point. It didn't happen in Europe. It did not happen in Europe. As late as 1990, people in Europe were still using chlorofluorocarbon-containing spray cans. Why? I think just because the environmental movement didn't have the power in Europe that it had in the United States in those days. It does now. I think that's clear. So the bottom line message is that people have to organize. People have to do what they can to put pressure on corporations and put pressure on governments. When that happens, a lot of things can change because basically, as long as there are options of other things to do, then you can force a change.
That's really interesting. I think finally, I'd just like to ask you, you know, what's your advice for young people, some of whom are, you know, very frightened about the climate change and the risks we see today. If someone wants to go into science and use it to make a difference on climate change, what kind of advice would you give to them?
Well, if a person is interested in becoming a climate scientist, I say bravo, and you know, it's going to be a wild ride, but you can have a fantastic scientific career because there's a lot of things that need doing. I think what we're going to see is this planet is going to transform at an incredible rate. We're already seeing things like increased flooding. We're seeing things like changes in wildfire area burned and the environmental effects of that, including pollution events that are just astonishingly bad. So the responses of the planet to the climate change that we're forcing are going to be very important things to study and bring that necessary science to the conversation. So that's what a scientist can do. What a non-scientist can do is continue to put pressure on society for change. When you look at what's happened in the United States, the Inflation Reduction Act, which had a huge amount of good stuff in it for climate change, that only happened because of pressure by young people on Joe Biden when, you know, particularly when he was a candidate, to tell him, hey, we're not going to vote for you unless you make climate your number one thing to do. And indeed, he fulfilled the promise that he made to do that. But, you know, groups like the Sunrise Movement are credited with having forced him to do that. That's a group of young people. So I think that organizing to find ways to put pressure on politicians, use your voting power. That's what they did. Go ahead and, you know, get a sign and peacefully demonstrate in front of, you know, the White House or Parliament or wherever else you want to do it. You know, don't ever get violent and don't get arrested, but, you know, demonstrate and express your opinion. I think those things are very important. For older people, one of the main things that they can do is put pressure on banks. You know, go ahead and tell your bank you don't like the way they're investing. You know, you can do that with a sign too. Or go ahead and change your bank or change your portfolio of retirement investments to put them more in sustainability stocks and less in other kinds of stocks. There's a lot of power that the consumer has and we just have to use it.
Thank you so much. It's really been an honor to meet you and great to hear from you both about science and about the wider routes to social change. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
So finally, we have the chance to have a debrief where Idan and I put our heads together and try to make sense of the array of fascinating things that we've just heard. Idan, what has particularly stood out for you from all these interesting ideas and people?
Well, I think, Jane, the thing that really stuck with me was something that you said at the start of the episode, actually, that was carried on as a thread throughout by our various guests. I think Jakob mentioned this, and I think Zia mentioned this as well, but the term polycrisis when discussing climate change, I thought was a really good way of thinking about it. Because I know in this, within NEVER, we were trying to integrate these different strands of existential risk. But in these episodes, we've kind of looked at them on their, you know, by themselves, these different facets. But I do love how you can't even look at climate change without thinking about other issues linked to it, such as, you know, the effect of new tech, whether that's going to have a transformational role in combating the climate crisis, things like that. You know, you can't look at climate change without looking at other effects linked to it and other kind of like crises affecting it as well, whether that's new tech solutions, whether that's kind of like work at the international level. Likewise, we're doing with other issues as well. I find it quite interesting to think about how it's not just the matter of the world is warming, how do we stop it? There is so much more linked into it across existential risk and beyond as well. And I also really liked how in this episode, a lot of the human effects of existential risk have been touched on a lot. Both Zia and Olivia Blake talked a lot about the local levels and the real world effects on people's lives, and how this is an issue that does mobilise people because they can see it, which might be a bit different to some of the other existential risks we've discussed, because normal people can't exactly see it. And likewise, Katie was really, really valuable, I think, in mentioning public trust and how, as much as a lot of these sort of like exciting technological solutions you might see in the news are good, we can't build up the public's trust too much on them without doing the actual hard political work to ensure that we have a world that is like climate change resilient. And I thought there was a lot of interesting discussions. But if a gun to my head, had to choose some, those were what I found most interesting. What about yourself, Jane?
Well, please don't put a gun to my head, but I can definitely pick up on a couple of things. I think, you know, the multiple crises things are interesting, and we can add into that what is probably fair to describe as a crisis in multilateralism for countries that already have a dominant role in multilateralism. It's seen as a kind of fight over the future of the global order. I think for a lot of countries in the so-called global south, it's about trying to expand who has a seat at the table in multilateralism. But anyway, all of this stuff about, you know, how the UN works, who drives the implementation of international law, etc. This is all extremely contested and political right now. And so that affects climate, you know, as much as it affects every other issue of international cooperation. And the debates about how you tackle climate change among countries have always been really entangled with questions of fairness, you know, and who should make the sacrifices when some countries were the first to industrialize before there was any pressure to decarbonize. I think it's so important that we do have that framework provided by the Paris Accords, and I do wonder whether it would be possible to actually reach such an agreement today if we were starting from scratch. But then more at the local level that you talk about, where, you know, people are seeing effects on their daily lives, I just thought it was so interesting how much activism has been a recurring theme in the discussion. And when I had that chance to talk to Susan Solomon, who I was so thrilled to meet, it was really interesting to me to hear from a scientist about the importance of public campaigning and persuading and incentivizing the private sector also to act through that kind of public campaigning. So, you know, I hope our chat about the poly crisis does not distract from the fact that there is so much that people can do in their normal lives and in their political decisions and how they show up in civil society that can really make a difference here.
No, absolutely, absolutely. I think that's what's nice about, well, there's nothing exactly nice about climate change, but what's nice about it is kind of like almost this entry into existential risk for the citizen. This is the one that most people will have heard of and will have heard of, like, you know, in their town, in their village, in their city, some sort of local group that can do things. But then what I think is good about, you know, the work we're doing, for instance, on this podcast and a lot of the kind of activist level stuff on climate change is it gives you a toolkit almost to respond to the other existential risks that we are facing. I think it was John Pope in our last episode mentioned when we were discussing nuclear weapons, you know, treat it like you would any other political issue when it comes to the ballot in terms of like organizing. And I feel that lesson has been most applied so far in climate change. But then that's a beautiful learning experience, if anything, for people working in disruptive technologies, for people working in the nuclear field, for people working in biological existential risks. You know, it's the climate change movement, that activism is almost a template. There's more to be done. But I think it's good every now and then to step back and just think about the work that has been done already for a little mini pat on the back moment almost across society.
Yeah, and I'm old enough to remember when climate change wasn't this big driving force of activism and when, for example, journalists would sigh that they found it really difficult to get stories about climate change because you couldn't yet see the dramatic effects and it was a kind of slow burn issue in a way. So I think that's something useful for today's students and recent graduates to be aware of as well, is that, you know, there has been a real change and the activism of young people has really been a factor that has pushed these issues up the political agenda where they were previously not taken as seriously.
I think almost on that note with the political agenda, one thing that I think was mentioned throughout the episode and I think is something that once again applies to a lot of our other episodes and a lot of the other work on existential risk is this idea of national priorities. And I can remember the first thing that both Ji Chung and Zia started out with in the panel was this very common concept, I think, we're dealing with now within this the course of this podcast series of governments know there's an issue, they know they should do more about it, but they're so distracted by the noise of a million and two other more immediate priorities. It almost feels a lot like with climate change. As you were saying then, people weren't talking about it when it was this slow burn, but now the horse has indeed bolted. Suddenly people are playing catch up almost. And so as much as I was saying just then about we can be proud of the activism, I think there are a lot of lessons as well, especially in regards to things that are like maybe newer existential threats, like these tech things that are only just getting on the radar now, to learn the good lessons of, you know, activism, organising, local engagement from the climate crisis, but also the lessons that the things we don't want to emulate in the sense of kind of letting it go too far before we suddenly all start organising and scrabbling for action.
Completely, and we'll have a chance to dig more into some of those other risks and the cross-cutting ideas and lessons in our next episode, so looking forward to that.
Absolutely, Jane, and I'm looking forward to digging into that further in our upcoming episodes where we'll be exploring AI, other technologies that are emerging and disruptive, as well as biological risk. Thank you for listening, and remember, it's all okay, Doomer.